We are all in need of exhortation, brother and sister. We look now to our brother James to give us those words of exhortation to prepare us for the partaking of bread and wine. Brother James, please.
Well, good morning again, everyone. Joshua, by any standards, had a very long and a very full life. He was born into slavery in Egypt. He was witness to the 10 plagues and to Passover night and to crossing the Red Sea. And he spent 40 years in the wilderness. And he spied out the land, and along with Caleb, he was one of the ones who said that they could go in. And 38 years later, he had taken over the leadership role of the nation and did indeed lead the people in. And the rivers of the Jordan were parted, and through they went, and they fought against Jericho and Ai, and they had a conquest of the land. And now the land has rest. The Lord had given rest to Israel. And Joshua, at 110 years old, says, I'm old, and I'm well advanced in years. And he knows that he is going to die soon. And he wants to leave some encouragement, some exhortation to the people before he does die. And so he summons all Israel. This is Joshua 23, verse 2. He summons all Israel, its elders, its heads, its judges, its officers, and he gives them his final address. And one of the things that he seems to be most concerned about, or one of the things he really wants to impress into the minds of the people who are there to hear his address, is that they mustn't revert to the faithlessness and the idolatry that had sometimes characterized the generation that perished in the wilderness. Just have a look at chapter 23 with me, verse 6. Therefore be very strong to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, turning aside from it neither to the right hand nor to the left, that you may not mix with these nations remaining among you, or make mention of the names of their gods, or swear by them, or serve them, or bow down to them. But you shall cling to the Lord your God, just as you have done this day. Don't mix with those nations, don't swear by the names of their gods. Verse 12. For if you turn back and cling to the remnant of these nations remaining among you, and make marriages with them so that you associate with them and they with you, know for certain that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. But there shall be a snare and a trap for you, a whip on your sides and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from off this good ground that the Lord your God has given you. And verse 16, if you transgress the covenant of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, and go and serve other gods and bow down to them, then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and you shall perish quickly from off the good land that he has given to you. And you get some sense of the earnestness and the urgency with which Joshua is addressing the people. Because he's speaking from experience, of course. You know, these are not unfounded fears on Joshua's part. He'd been there. He had seen what could and what would happen if the people turned away from God. You remember, he was coming down the mountain with Moses while the people were dancing around the golden calf below, saying, "These are your gods who brought you out of the land of Egypt," because we don't know what's happened to Moses. And Joshua's coming down and he says, "Oh, there is the noise of war in the camp." And Moses says, that's not war, that's dancing and singing. And they come down and they find the people there with the golden calf. And on that occasion, the call goes out, who is on the Lord's side? And it's the Levites who answer the call, and they're told, well, strap on your sword and go through the camp and kill your brothers. And what a terrible event in that wilderness journey, because the people turned away from God and they bowed down to the golden calf instead. And God had made it clear, as we were saying this morning, he wasn't prepared to tolerate this unfaithfulness. This is what he said in Exodus 20. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. Later on in the wilderness journey, it's recorded in Numbers, Balak hired Balaam to speak against Israel and to curse them. And you'll remember how God protected his people, and Balaam found he couldn't curse them. Instead, he could only bless them. But although he failed in that regard, he succeeded in suggesting that the daughters of the Moabites and of the Midianites should be offered to the sons of Israel. And when they'd intermarried and when they'd associated, then they should also be invited to the sacrifices and the feasts for their gods. And Numbers 25 verse 3 says, so Israel yoked himself to the Baal of Peor. And you know what that image is, the yoke placed over the backs of the oxen or whatever animals you're using. And that image is used by Jesus. He says, take my yoke upon you. And Paul uses the same image. Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers. And that's exactly what they had done. They yoked themselves to Baal. And again, on that occasion, the Israelites are told to go and kill some of their own people. And God brings a plague, and the plague is only stopped when Phinehas, you know, takes his javelin and he sticks it through Zimri and Cosby. But not before a lot of people have been killed by the plague. And Joshua was there. He was old enough to remember these incidents. And so he gathers the people together, and he is desperate that this should not happen again. He knows that he has had a massive influence over the people in the time that he has been leading them. And in fact, at the end of chapter 24, we realize that Israel served the Lord not only in Joshua's day, but also in all the days of the elders who had outlived Joshua and had known what God had done for them. Such was Joshua's influence. But he knows that he's worried for the future. And he pleads with them that they shouldn't turn away from God like the generation in the wilderness did who perished. And it's not just Joshua. Just have a look at the previous chapter, chapter 22. The people themselves remember what happens when they turn away from God. We won't read much of this chapter for the sake of time, but this is the occasion where the tribes on the east, that's Reuben and Gad and half of the tribe of Manasseh, they build an altar, which the ESV describes as an altar of imposing size. It's the end of verse 10. They build an altar by the Jordan. And the tribes on the west, everyone else, the 10.5 tribes, are furious. And they gather together, and they are ready to make war with the eastern tribes. And they send a delegation of Phinehas and some of the heads of each of the western tribes, and they go over and speak to the tribes on the east, because their concern is, what do you think you're doing? Building an altar that you're going to worship at and offer sacrifices on, rather than coming over the river and coming to the tabernacle the way that God has commanded. And this is what they say, verse 16 of chapter 22. Thus says the whole congregation of the Lord, what is this breach of faith that you have committed against the God of Israel in turning away this day from following the Lord by building yourselves an altar this day in rebellion against the Lord? Have we not had enough of the sin at Peor, from which even yet we have not cleansed ourselves, and for which there came a plague upon the congregation of the Lord, that you too must turn away this day from following the Lord? And if you two rebel against the Lord today, then tomorrow he will be angry with the whole congregation of Israel. And you see how Joshua's urgency is shared by this delegation that goes across. Have you got such a short memory that you don't remember what happened at Peor when God brought a plague upon us because of exactly this? We turned away. And that wasn't the motivation of the eastern tribes. And we'll come back to what their motivation was a little bit later. But just for now, I'd notice the urgency with which they say, let's not go back to the ways of our fathers, turning away from God in the wilderness. So what is Joshua going to do about this? Well, he doesn't just throw his hands up in despair at the thought that at some point in the future this is bound to happen. People will turn away from God and God will punish them at some point. Nor does he just leave it at a warning that God will punish them. He does warn them, but he does more than just warn them. He gives them some practical steps to make sure that these punishments don't come upon them. And I'm going to try and summarise them for the sake of your memory and mine as a call to remember, a call to read, and a call to respond. So the first step is that he asks them to remember what God had done for them in the past. So chapter 23 and verse 3. You have seen all that the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. For it is the Lord your God who has fought for you. Remember everything that God has done for you. And in fact, chapter 24, the first half of chapter 24, is a record of exactly that. The things that God had done for them. Starting with, remember that Abraham was taken from Ur. And then he was given Isaac. And then Jacob and his family went down into Egypt. And then remember that the 10 plagues came. And then that you crossed the Red Sea. Remember that God provided for the people in the wilderness. He protected you from Balaam, the son of Beor. He fought against Jericho and the other nations. And he's given you a land with its cities that you didn't need to build. And vineyards that you didn't need to plant. And orchards that you didn't need to labour for. Just think of everything that God has done for you. For it is the Lord your God who has fought for you. So it seems to me that the first step and one of the points of Joshua's address is just to encourage people to remember. And having remembered, now you should read. So again, verse 6 of chapter 23. Therefore, be very strong to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, turning aside from it neither to the right hand or to the left. And of course, by read, I don't just mean reading, but reading and meditating upon and then doing it. Turning aside neither to the right hand or to the left. And those words should sound familiar to us. Just come back to chapter 1 of Joshua. Because these are the very same words with which Joshua himself is encouraged after the death of Moses. So chapter 1 and verse 6. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law that Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. And that was a personal commission for Joshua in very unique circumstances. You know, Joshua was called on to serve God in a way that you and I will never be asked to, leading a whole nation of his people, taking over after the death of Moses. But Joshua recognizes the encouragement that is given to him here isn't only something for him. It's something that he's carried with him all the way through the book of Joshua, and now he's reached the end of his life, and he calls all of Israel together and he says, "This is as relevant for you lot as it was for me. Remember the things that God has done for you. Think back over your life and reflect upon the things that you've seen and the things that you've heard that God has done for his people. And then read and meditate upon the law that he has given to you. When you meditate upon it, when you keep these things in your mind, allow your conscience to be informed by it and allow your decisions to be directed by it, and you will be prosperous and you will have good success." And Joshua, in his own life, knew that to be true. And he passes on that encouragement to the rest of the people. And now, once you've read, there has to be some kind of response. You need to choose what you're going to do. And Joshua puts the choice before them in chapter 24. So remember the first half of chapter 24, Joshua has recounted all of the good things that God has done for his people, and he's given them cities and vineyards and olive orchards up to the end of verse 13, and he says, "Now therefore, how are you going to respond to these things? Fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your father served or the gods of the Amorites. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." If you've remembered everything that God has done and you've read his law, then you have to choose. You can't remain indifferent to these things. You can't sit on the fence. What's it going to be? Are you going to serve God? Are you going to serve the gods of Egypt or the gods of the Amorites? And Joshua says, "Well, as for me and my house, well, we've decided we will serve the Lord." Maybe don't come back there, but it'd just be interesting maybe afterwards to compare what Moses says in Deuteronomy 30. Remember, that's Moses' final address to the people before they go into the land. And he's been recounting all of the things that have happened over the wilderness journey and what God has done for them. And he comes to the climax around about chapter 30, and he reaches the same point. You now have to make a decision. You need to choose. Is it life or is it death? And he urges the people, choose life. You reach a point where you make a choice. You have some kind of response to the things that God has done. And that's exactly what Joshua says here. And so the people answer, verse 16, "Far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord to serve other gods. For it is the Lord who brought our fathers out of the land of Egypt, who did great signs, who preserved us in the way that we went, and the peoples through whom we passed. And he drove out the people, the Amorites who lived in the land. And they remember, yes, we remember the things that God has done for us. Therefore," verse 18, "we also will serve the Lord, for he is our God." And you might imagine that Joshua will be thrilled by that response. Well, that's exactly why he has called the people together. That's exactly what he wants to hear from them. Instead, he warns them, you must be sincere if you're making this commitment. Joshua says, "You are not able to serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgression or your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, he will turn and do you harm and consume you after having done you good." And he wants the people to reiterate, "No, we will choose to serve the Lord." there in verse 21. And so Joshua's address to the people finishes, and they make this commitment that day that they will serve God. And we might wonder what any of this has to do with us. This all happened in very different circumstances to ours. God's people were a nation at that time. They'd fought a campaign to drive out the other nations from a particular land. We are just not in the same situation as they were. Well, just have a look, please, at Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3, and from verse 7 to 11, the author of Hebrews quotes from Psalm 95, discussing the same thing that Joshua was talking about, the rebellion of those in the wilderness. Your fathers put me to the test and saw my works for 40 years, and I swore in my wrath, verse 11, they shall not enter my rest. And the reason for quoting that from the Psalms is to say, take care, brothers, lest there be in any of you an evil, unbelieving heart, leading you to fall away from the living God. But exhort one another every day, as long as it is called today, that none of you may be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. For we have come to share in Christ, if indeed we hold our original confidence firm to the end. And the reason I'm discussing these things is because we should not allow the same to happen to us. That was Joshua's concern. That was his preoccupation when he called the people together. Don't fall away. Don't be like that generation in the wilderness. And it's the same here in Hebrews. Don't have an unbelieving heart, but exhort and encourage and build up and edify one another, keeping our confidence firm to the end. And then into chapter 4, the argument is built up that the promise of entering God's rest, which is how Joshua 23 started, that Joshua had entered into that rest, that God had given his people rest and had given the land rest. And the argument runs in Hebrews chapter 4, that hope and that promise of entering that rest is still open. It's not been completed. It's not been fulfilled. Therefore, this is verse 1, while the promise of entering his rest still stands, let us fear lest any of you should seem to have failed to reach it. And to summarize what is argued over the next half of the chapter or so, there was a promise that people could enter into God's rest. And to some degree, that was fulfilled in Joshua's day when the people entered the promised land. However, David was still talking about the rest when he wrote Psalm 95. And the argument runs, well, if David is still talking about it, centuries after Joshua, then clearly it wasn't complete in Joshua's day. God has appointed another day, today. So verse 8, if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken of another day later on. So then there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For whoever has entered God's rest has also rested from his works as God did from his. This promise of entering the rest, of entering the promised land, is still open to God's people. It's still open to you and I. So Joshua's address and exhortation at the very moment at which they are claiming that inheritance and claiming that rest is as relevant for us now who are still hoping to enter it as for that generation in his day that did enter the land. And Joshua exhorted them to remember, to read, and to respond. And so Hebrews goes on, verse 11, let us therefore strive to enter that rest, so that no one may fall by the same sort of disobedience. Good news has come to us in verse 2, in the same way as it did to them. And we've thought about how some people failed to enter that rest. And Joshua doesn't want that for you, and the writer to the Hebrews doesn't want that for you either. Let us strive to enter that rest. Remember the things God has done for us. Read his word, meditate upon it, and follow the things he teaches us to do. And then respond to these things. Who are we going to decide to serve? Let's just finish off Joshua chapter 24. Because Joshua does one more thing before he dismisses the people in chapter 24. Joshua, having made the people reiterate that they are going to serve the Lord and warning them that they must be earnest in their commitment to do so, he says, well, we will take a great stone. Verse 27, Joshua said to all the people, behold, this stone shall be a witness against us, for it has heard all the words of the Lord that he spoke to us. Therefore it shall be a witness against you, lest you deal falsely with your God. And with those words, he sent the people away, every man to his inheritance. And at first you might think, well, it's a little bit strange, isn't it? Joshua has already impressed on the people the solemn nature of the resolution that they're making. Why does he need to make this show of calling this stone to be a witness? Well, it's because Joshua knows what people are like. He knows what human nature is like. It's fickle, and sometimes an idol that can be seen, even if it's only made of wood or stone, it can hold some sort of attraction that an invisible God doesn't hold. Joshua knows that something physical, something tangible, is helpful. The people could come back to this place. They could see that stone. They could remember the day on which they said to Joshua, we will serve the Lord. And Joshua said, are you sure? He's a jealous God. And they said, yes, we will serve the Lord. They could remember that occasion, the point at which they made that commitment. And the stone is still there that Joshua set up. And that's helpful. And in the same way, in chapter 22, just to finish the story that we started in chapter 22, remember the delegation from the western tribes has come and has said, why have you built this altar? Are you going to turn away from God? And the response of the eastern tribes is, kind of halfway through what they're saying, but verse 26, therefore we said, let us now build an altar, not for burnt offering, nor for sacrifice, but to be a witness between us and you, and between our generations after us, that we do perform the service of the Lord in his presence with our burnt offerings and sacrifices and peace offerings, so your children will not say to our children in time to come, you have no portion in the Lord. And we thought, if this should be said to us or to our descendants in time to come, we should say, behold the copy of the altar of behold the copy of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, not for burnt offerings, not for sacrifice, but to be a witness between us and you. And the tribes on the east say, we're not turning away from God. It's helpful to have something physical that we can look at, that we can remember, that our children will be able to come to, and to remember that we are part of this nation, we are part of this inheritance, even though we're divided by the River Jordan. Now, why am I talking about this? Well, it seems to me that that's at least part of the point of baptism. Have you ever considered why does God give us some physical act to perform? Well, when we make a decision that we're going to commit our lives to God, Why is it that he says, okay, now you need to perform some physical act? You need to go down into the water. What would be wrong with just saying in our hearts that we are sinners and we thank God for Jesus' sacrifice, and from this day forward we dedicate ourselves to him? And it seems to me that it's for our benefit. If we don't have to do anything physical to make that commitment, and I think probably the thief on the cross demonstrates that better than anyone. We sometimes get a little bit flustered over the thief on the cross and say, well, maybe he'd been baptized by John, or the fact he was actually dying with Christ is like baptism, but even better. Well, isn't the simple explanation that Jesus had authority on earth to forgive sins? It was his prerogative to assure this thief that he would be with him in paradise, whether he'd been baptized or not. So baptism is not for Christ's benefit or not for God's benefit. They're not. They don't have their hands tied. Well, I'd like to save you, but you haven't been baptized. The point is that it's helpful for us. We have a definite moment in time, for me, the 12th of September 2003, where I can remember I made my commitment to serve God. And there was a room full of people who heard me make that commitment. And we say the words on this public confession of your faith, and that's what it is. And it's a powerful thing, asking one another to witness and to uphold the commitment that we've made. And in the same way, God knew that people needed something physical to remind them of the things that he'd done for them on Passover night. That was the point of celebrating the Passover, to remember what God had done for them, and they were to talk about it, and their children were to ask about it, and they were to explain the purpose of the things that they were doing and why they were eating that meal. And Jesus knew it would be helpful for us to have something physical, something tangible to remember him by as well. And so he says, eat the bread and drink the wine and do it in remembrance of me. And so Joshua calls on us to remember what God has done. And to that end, we have bread and we have wine. To read God's law and to meditate upon it and to keep it. And to decide how we are going to respond. So to finish with some more words from Hebrews, let us therefore strive to enter that rest. Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Thank you. Thank you.